Hi there, Shan Chi here, Executive Director at Byron Writers Festival. And you're listening to the Deep Dives podcast series recorded live at Byron Writers Festival in 2023. Coming up in the next session, titled All the Living and the Dead, is a fascinating conversation between Hayley Campbell and Kerry Sunderland.
Jingi Walla, hello everyone, and welcome to this session, All the Living and the Dead. I would like to acknowledge that we are gathering here on the lands of the Arakwal people of the Bunjalung Nation and pay my respects to the traditional owners of these lands and acknowledge them as the original storytellers of this region. So we're here today to discuss All the Living and the Dead, a very sticky noteworthy book, in my opinion, which is a deep dive, very appropriate given the name of this tent, into the death industry with profiles of those who make a living working with the dead, from bereavement midwives to grave diggers and crematorium operators and everyone in between. And even beyond, with the final chapter exploring those who sign up to put themselves on ice in the hope that one day someone will be able to bring them back to life. So the author of this extraordinary book is UK-based Hayley Campbell. Thank you for joining me today, Hayley. And if you haven't already seen Hayley speak at the festival, she is an author, journalist and broadcaster who travels the world to report on everything from typefaces to film stars. And she wrote a book. Her first book is The Art of Neil Gaiman, which delves into the creative mind of one of our most celebrated authors in the world. Interestingly, Hayley spent quite a bit of her childhood and teen years, I think, living just up the road in Brisbane, where she developed an early fascination with death and dying, which she describes in what I believe is a really sublime and masterful personal essay, which you call the introduction to the book.
And it also explains my accent.
Yes.
Not London.
Yeah, so I found my experience with death and dying reflected on the very first page when in the second paragraph, Hayley writes, and I'm just paraphrasing very briefly, "You aren't born knowing you will die. Some people remember being told. They have a moment they can pinpoint where life cleaved into before and after. Maybe death came to you in the form of a goldfish or a grandparent." So that was me. I have both the grandparent experience of the age of about 3 or 4 and the goldfish experience at about the age of 7. But you weren't one of those people. You can't remember a time when death didn't exist. Death was just there, everywhere, always. And we're about to find out what role, I'm really curious about what this role, this early awareness of death and your perspective played in the making of this book and whether it, I was going to say, adequately prepared you for what you were about to discover as you stood again and again at the intersection of wonder and fear. So thank you so much, Hayley, for joining us today. And I just wanted to give you a hint too that while we're going to dive pretty deep and we're going to talk about some things that people find really difficult to talk about, I wanted to give you a little glimmer of what the what you'll be able to take away from this, and I think you articulate it beautifully when you say there is an urgent life-changing knowledge to be gained from becoming familiar with death, and from not letting your limits be guided by a fear of unknown things, the knowledge that you can stand to be near it, so that when the time comes, you will not let someone you love die alone. I mean, I think that's just, that really speaks to me. So I know we've already clapped a few times, but please give me another round of applause to Hayley.
Thank you. Yeah.
So I'd like to start with your early awareness of death. You write, maybe it began with 5 dead women. Tell us about that and whether it was fascination or fear that meant you, unlike many people, couldn't look away.
Well, my dad is a comic book artist. He drew From Hell, which is a graphic novel by Alan Moore about the Jack the Ripper murders. So when I was a kid, he had all of these reference pictures stuck up on his drawing board of autopsy photographs of these women, crime scene photographs, and Jack the Ripper crime scene pictures are not your regular crime scene pictures. They're bloody. Well, these were black and white, but I was used to them, and I wasn't frightened by them. I was fascinated by them, and I only saw them as these frightening things when I brought friends home from school who would go, what is that? And it was, I think they found it weird for a couple of reasons. One was it was pictures of dead women, but also my dad was always there. They're like, what's he doing? And I thought that all dads were staying at home drawing pictures of dead ladies. But in actual fact, they had jobs. Like, they were lawyers and accountants, and my experience was the unusual one. But I thought it was pretty normal. But I think because of that environment, whenever I had questions about death or dead bodies, my parents would try and answer them pretty honestly, trying not to be brutal with it, but trying to be honest, which I think still is the way you should speak to children. I think kids are a lot smarter and sturdier than we give them credit for. And you don't need to coat things in cotton wool. You don't need to hand children the emotion that they should deal with things. Like, you don't need to tell them how they should feel. Sometimes they just want to know what's going on, and they will process it in their own way, which was what I wanted. But when I went to school, it was a Catholic school, and I just found that I felt like people were lying to me, because instead of getting the practical scientific answers about what happened to dead bodies, I would get stories about souls and heaven and the afterlife. And I was like, I don't care about that. I just want to know what happens and how we become skeletons. And you get treated like a weird little kid when you ask stuff like that. But I still think I was right to ask them. And it was that questioning and that fascination that I carried with me all my life. And the best thing about being a journalist is you can exploit your position to basically investigate everything you are personally interested in. Mm. And this has been something I've been coming back to time and time again as a journalist, until one day I thought, I'm going to do this properly. I'm going to stop skirting around it. I'm going to go and speak to people. Because saying you're a journalist, saying you're writing a book, is like, do you remember in the X-Files, they'd like flash their card, I'm an FBI agent. If you say you're writing a book, people just let you in. They let you into the back rooms of places, and they say, what do you want to know? What do you want to see? And this book, like, so many people were so generous with their time in these incredibly busy jobs. And I couldn't believe it, because all I'd done was send them an email. I mean, I begged quite a bit, but some people said no. But when the people said yes, they were so welcoming, and they kind of looked at me like I was weird. Like, why do you want to know so much? Because their experience of their job is it's something that they should hide because people don't want to know. And I was asking I was basically asking the same questions I was when I was seven. Mm. I was just getting the proper answers now. Mm.
The book begins when you go to a conference at University College in London, and you meet a 30-something-year-old funeral director called Poppy, who told you something quite significant. So that was sort of like it serves as the inciting incident in the narrative of the book, doesn't it?
It really
is. Yeah.
So I had just gone along to this event. It was quite silly. We were holding a wake for a philosopher who'd been dead for over 200 years. I think he was long gone, but it was it was like a death-positive event. It was full of people like me who were interested in things, but it was full of people who ran death cafes and wanted to talk about society's backward attitude towards death. And Poppy was there to give a speech, and she's a very progressive funeral director, and she stood up and she said two things that really struck me. One of them was that she wished she could bring children into her mortuary so she could show them what a dead body looks like, show them what death looks like, before they actually had to do it in real life. So they had a chance to come to terms with the reality of somebody being a dead body and what that looks like before they had to deal with grief and loss, which I think is a brilliant way of doing it. She said that the other thing that really struck me was she said the first dead body you see should not be someone you love. And you should have the opportunity to separate, you know, the reality of of dead bodies and decomposition, which, when you're first shown it, can be really shocking. Even if it's just a normal death, it can be shocking. You don't know how you're going to react when you get in the room. But to have to deal with that at the same time as knowing that someone you love is gone forever is just a mess. But we in society don't get a chance to see dead bodies. I know, because I kept trying, I kept asking. I'd never seen a dead body until I wrote this book. And when I met Poppy at this event, I asked if I could interview her for it. And the interview turned into a long discussion, and I said, well, I've never seen a dead body. And she said, well, I'm not just going to get one out for you. Because she said, it's not like a museum. But if you want to come back and you want to be trained like you're coming to work here, you could spend a day with us in the mortuary dressing people for their coffins, and I think you would get a lot from it. And I was really shocked that she had in another back room. And it was astonishing. It wasn't what you think of as a mortuary. She had taken this dilapidated old burial chapel in the middle of a cemetery in South London. It was falling apart. The council didn't know what to do with it. And so she took it off their hands. She did it up. It's this beautiful chapel. It's got stained glass windows. Light comes in. It smells like wood. She hangs lavender upside down from the beams. And it's just got a row of fridges. And I spent a day in there dressing dead people. And when I went there, I was so nervous because I didn't know how I was going to react. I'd spent my life thinking about what dead bodies are like, and I've been told that they're frightening and we shouldn't be near them. And when people in my life died, they just go away. And then I got to see a dead body, and when they pulled him out into the middle of the room, I was sweaty and nervous and frightened, and they said, can you come and help us? Because the family wants to keep... He had a band T-shirt on, and it was the T-shirt he had died in, but the family wanted to keep it, so they had to take it off, and they said, can you come and hold his hands, because we need to take his top off. And as soon as I held his hands, he went from being a scary dead body, from all of this imagining that I had and all of this, you know, the nervousness on the way to the mortuary, as soon as I touched him, he was just a guy. And it became this profoundly sad experience, but also I felt sacred because I was one of the last people to be there with him. He was going in his coffin and the next day he would be cremated, so I was one of the last people to touch him, and I found it really special. And now I'm going to be like that with my own family. And I always encourage people I know who have family members die, they go, oh, I don't want to see them in hospital, I don't want to go. And I go, you have to. You don't know what you're going to get out of it, because something I want to do in this book is tell people that you shouldn't make these big decisions, like I don't want to see the dead body of my father or something. You shouldn't make these big decisions based on what people have told you in the past or what you believe you will feel, because it's transformative and you have no idea. And so so many friends have gone through things and I've said, you have to go. And if you can, dress them. And they've looked at me like I'm strange. And then later they've said, I'm so glad you forced me to do that. It was weird at the time, but an unforgettable experience. And I had that with a stranger.
Absolutely. And they are traditions that we have lost in many ways, because families used to do that, didn't they, before the industrialization of the funeral industry and so forth. So, and in fact, I imagine there's some in the audience who might be involved in the Natural Death Care Centre and or done their death walker training here in the Northern Rivers. And so that's an opportunity to encourage people and families to do that and take back control as well. Yep. So it's really good. Now, the majority of the death walkers you profile, and I want to come back to why Poppy was a bit more of an advanced funeral director, because she is a bit different because of her attitude to embalming. And so we'll talk about that in a bit more detail soon. But the majority of the death walkers you profile are those that you describe are at the industrial end of death, where the part where all the ceremony and courtesy of dealing with the living has passed. So I'm curious, how did you select your subjects? Because, yeah.
I had a big murder board, like they do in detective shows. I wanted to follow the body from deathbed to either burial or cremation. And I charted all of these people because death in Western culture is a kind of disappearing act. You pay people, they take the body away, you don't know what happens, and then, I mean, you sort of know what happens, but you're told these things in euphemisms. That's another thing I don't like about the death world. People talk about hygienic treatment instead of embalming, but then people don't even really know what embalming is either. So I wanted to follow the body because it goes through so many people, and all of these people are behind closed doors, and I just think they're hugely unappreciated. And it was only when I started following the body that I kind of consciously realized that there's these people we don't think about. And even along the way, I found people I hadn't thought about, and it was just through various incidents that I had to figure out. Such as the bereavement midwife. She's somebody I had never thought of before. But I went to interview her. So there's this huge workforce that we rely on practically, but also emotionally. They do so much emotional management on our behalf so we don't fall apart, but we don't even know what they're doing. And I just think they're kind of due some kind of celebration. This isn't like a celebration of them. It's just kind of an acknowledgement of why we need them and what they do.
Yeah. And tell us about the approvals process. You promised, for example, Dr. Philip Gore, you wouldn't turn it into some sort of horror story, which is something almost everyone you approached for this book had feared. Yeah.
They did. Well, it was really hard to get people to talk to me because any dealings they had had with journalists before had been awful, especially in the UK where we have tabloids and horrible, salacious stories, and the editors in the UK rewrite things or give you headlines that make whatever you wrote seem worse than what you meant. And so they regarded me with
suspicion,
and I think they were right to. So I had to do a lot of character, like layers and layers of character reference. I had to get, once I worked with one funeral director, I'd be like, can you tell this embalmer that I'm okay? And it took ages. I thought, when I initially pitched the book, I said, I'll be done in 12 months and you'll be able to print this book, it'll be done. It took me 4 years because just getting to talk to people was so hard. And also, I speak to people in the UK and America, but that wasn't entirely the plan. I had to go to wherever somebody would talk to me was. So there are medical schools in the UK, but I went to a medical school in the US because he would talk to me. Whereas the medical schools in the UK, you had to go through their media barriers, and they know what UK journalism is like, and they were like, no. So it was really tricky. It took a long time. I had an editor who was very forgiving, thankfully. But yeah, it was.
So at what really point hard. In the making of the book did you have a publishing contract? Was that fairly
before?
Oh, okay.
So I hadn't, and I read my proposal after I had finished my book, and it was bullshit. It was the most naive nonsense I have ever read. I was embarrassed that I had sent it to everybody. And I thought I knew what I was talking about. I thought I had like pre-written little chapter things, like I'll speak to this person and I'll see this and I'll probably feel this, because editors want to know what your conclusion is going to be before you've done any investigating, which is crazy. This is one of the book world things that is crazy. And yeah, reading it, I had no idea. Like I said before, you don't know how you're going to be. You don't know how you're going to react when you get into the room, and you don't know what your conclusion is going to be. So yeah, that proposal is never going to see the light of day again.
And I imagine that another reason this book took you 4 years to write was, I get a sense, certainly from the way the book is written, that you spent quite a lot of time with people. It's not like you just went in and did a one-hour interview and wrote up your interview notes. You were, it was experiential, wasn't it? You were there, you were seeing them do their work, you were, I got the sense you were hanging out with them for a long time, if not days, perhaps longer.
I was. Yeah. But the thing is, something that's sad about the pandemic is people think that Zoom interviews are okay now, and they're not, because there's the stuff that people tell you in speech, and then there's the stuff that is so normal to them that they don't even mention it and is hugely crucial. Like when I went to hang out with the gravediggers in Bristol in the UK, something I noticed, I was watching them dig a grave, and something I noticed that was that he had this little, like, it was a little urn of dirt, and it was something he would put beside the vicar's feet so that when he did the ashes to dust bit and he threw dirt onto the coffin, that was there. That was what it was used for. But I noticed that the dirt that came out of the grave was really heavy, wet clay. And the stuff that was in this little container was fine. It was really soft dust. And this gravedigger had been doing this job since he was about 14, and he was now in his 70s. And so this was something that was now so normal to him that he would never think to mention it. But when I asked him about it, he said, oh, those are molehills that I collect from my garden. Because when the vicar throws it, he didn't want the heavy clay to land on a box and go thunk. Because then the grievers are conscious that this is a box, and it kind of ruins the vibe of the ceremony. So he had this thing of molehills. But if I had just spoken to him for an hour, or if I had been on Zoom, he never would have thought of that, because it's just not something. He stopped thinking about that 50 years ago. It was just something he had now.
Yeah, a little trade secret that you've revealed.
Exactly.
In chapter two, we meet Terry, who's the director of anatomical services at the Mayo Clinic. And you write, he's not the kind of guy to euphemise facts and bubble wrap your feelings. He'll tell you everything you want to know and some things you don't. And your writing gives me the sense that you are the same.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and actually, you in your afterword, you write that you didn't want to make any assumptions, or you're not hiding anything from the reader. And that was, I mean, that's one of the things that makes some parts of the book, wow, very, you know, confronting and challenging. And, but you, it is a no hold, you know, no, it's a very candid account of your experiences. So tell us what's wrong with euphemisms. I mean, you mentioned it early in the session, but it's a decision not to use them, but how are they problematic?
I think if you speak in euphemisms, and when I say euphemisms, I mean things as simple as if somebody throws themselves off a building and you say they passed away. It's not, just say somebody died. There's nothing wrong with saying somebody died. But in the funeral industry, there are euphemisms that kind of bamboozle the customer. So hygienic treatment instead of embalming. So people say okay to this thing that they don't know what it is. And I don't know if anyone's ever read Jessica Mitford's The American Way of Death, but it's this kind of very bitchy book about the... She wrote it in the 60s, and it's... her theory was that the American funeral industry was preying on the vulnerable by kind of not explaining exactly what people were paying for and giving the impression that the dead body was toxic to be around and unhealthy and should not be touched by anyone who isn't especially trained to be near a dead body. And that attitude is still very prevalent. When I told people what I was doing for a book, when I told them I dressed the man for his coffin, they're like, oh, are you allowed to do that? And you are. It's just that they don't tell you. And so you end up paying for things like embalming, not realizing that you don't really need it, unless you're repatriating a body to another country and it's going to be on a plane or it's going to be traveling around. Like, you know, the Queen would have been heavily embalmed. because she was sitting out in different places. But if a person dies and is buried a week later, you don't need that. But I think, so the euphemism's a problem because people pay for things they don't need. But I also think that if you don't tell people the truth of what has happened, or if you say, you know, you just kind of, if you're fluffy with how things are, speaking as somebody who was, you know, curious about these things and was a kid with questions, I know that if you're not given concrete information, you fill that space with everything you've kind of picked up from TV and films, and it's usually horror. And I don't think that's helpful emotionally. So it's people kind of trying to be helpful and trying to bubble wrap your feelings, but in actual fact, they're just making space for you to be horrified.
I mean, we were talking just in the green room, though, perhaps, about talking about feelings and emotions being the ultimate taboo in many ways for a lot of people. Because you just mentioned embalming, I'm going to jump forward to ask a little bit more about that now. I think it's somewhere between 50 and 55% of bodies in the UK and probably something similar in the US are embalmed. It's quite a lot less here.
Okay.
It's quite a lot higher in New Zealand where I live partly because of the tradition of the Māori tangihanga, where the body's on display for family to be with for 3 days.
There's a reason for it.
Yeah, but it's not all necessary in some parts of New Zealand, which are quite cold.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So why do you think embalming is more common? Is it because it's more industrial, the funeral industry in the UK and the US? Or?
Well, I think in the US it's a case of there's a lot more open casket funerals.
Okay.
And funeral cosmetic stuff is much more of a thing than in the UK. The UK, the main reason they do it in the UK is scheduling. Like, it's something as silly as scheduling, because there's so many people and so few places where someone can be cremated or buried that they have to try and organize all the schedules and timetables. And so it might be 3 or 5 weeks before somebody is buried. So that's another reason for embalming.
Mm.
And you just sit in a fridge until such a time that they can find space for you on the schedule.
Yeah, where was it? In the middle of winter, they had to store the body for some time while they waited for the ground to thaw before someone could be buried.
Yeah, Wisconsin.
Yeah.
So in the Midwest, it just gets so frozen that they can't dig a hole. They can't break the ground. So they will store coffins in above ground mausoleums. They'll just, like, tuck them in with other families. And then when spring comes and the ground thaws, they will put them in their proper graves.
Yeah.
But they, the farmers who work with the ground will sometimes pay extra for them to put a big heater over the grass and to thaw the ground so they can break the ground. But farmers do this because they know that it's so much colder above ground than it is under the ground, and they can't live with the idea of their mother or their father being so cold. Which is kind of sweet, but also maybe a pain in the ass for the grave diggers.
A little bit of a challenge. So you've also mentioned how you advise all your friends and anyone you talk to be with their loved ones when they die and be with the body, because it's such a powerful experience. And you explore that quite a lot in your book when you are interviewing people like disaster victim identifiers and that whole sense, that kind of concept of closure, where if somebody's body is missing, that having the body back will make a big difference to that person. Can you expand a little bit on what you learnt about how important it is for in those sort of, you know, kind of more unusual circumstances?
So I spoke to a man who works with a disaster victim identification crew. He's basically, if there's a tsunami or a plane crash, so disasters, man-made or natural, there's this company that has people who, there are embalmers, there are detectives, there's all sorts of, it's like an apocalypse crew comes in with a big tent and figures everything out. But their goal is to collect the pieces of people and identify them and send them home to their families. And in the case of a plane crash, you might have like tiny, tiny pieces, pieces no bigger than an orange for one person. But huge amounts of money are put into identifying that person by DNA and sending them home to the family, because in something as, you know, abrupt and shocking as a plane crash, it's hugely important for people to have just some part of the person to come back to. And we saw this with the recent submarine crash with the just explosion. And people not being able to fathom, oh, that's it. We heard it exploded and we don't get anything back. Mm. And a plane crash is always going to be open-ended. Something I learned is that closure is a kind of insurance company word, that the families of the victims never get closure and a crash never ends. And so that is a kind of goal that you can chase forever and never reach. But there is something, much like you're not going to go and see the body if it's just a piece of a person. But being present with them in the room is another, it's helping you reckon with what has just happened. Otherwise, it's just something you've been told.
Yeah. Am I right in understanding that in the process of doing these interviews, you at one point you were a little bit skeptical about how valuable it was, and then you met somebody who told you that seeing the body is a signpost, a mark on the trail of grief, and that sort of was a, you know, something that you realised actually, yeah, it does really make a difference.
Yeah. Well, we grow up, we have funerals; it's all part of the routine. The admin of death has something to do with the body, and if that is taken away from you, then you have nothing. Mm. Then how do you process what's happened? I've become quite a practical person when it comes to death and dead bodies, and just having something tangible, even if it's unrecognizable to you, is huge. And another thing that the disaster crew do is they collect personal effects, which is something the police don't really bother with, because it's not going to solve a crime. It's just, you know, it's nothing. So I don't know if you heard about, there was an apartment block in London that burned down called Grenfell, and lots of people died in there. And so they worked on the identification of people, but they also spent months trawling through all the pieces of furniture and things and dragging out any, like, bikes and prams and high chairs. And when I visited their office, they had this huge warehouse of boxes of things that they had pulled from this building, and they were washing them and they were finding the families to return them to, even if it was just a T-shirt or a sock. They were like, we found this in your flat. Do you want it back? And one thing they found was a tank of fish, just goldfish, and there were 27 dead fish in it. But despite the fact that there had been no oxygenated water, there was no food, there were 6 fish still alive. And this was weeks after the burning of the building. And so these workers brought them back to the warehouse. They located the family who had lived in that flat and said, do you want this back? And they said, we don't actually have anywhere to live at the moment, so we can't take the fish, but can you look after them? And one of the workers took them home and gave them a new tank and new water, and they managed to breed. And so the strangest thing to come out of this burning building was a fish, a baby fish, and they called him Phoenix. But that is something that the police wouldn't ever do. It's just this company is so invested in not just getting, you know, collecting the bodies and doing the burial. They're doing emotional management. And they said that personal effects are hugely important, because they're not just stuff. They have stuff with emotional weight tied to them, and it is not your job to decide how heavy it is, because something that somebody had with them at the moment they died becomes hugely powerful.
Yeah, absolutely. And you write also about the memory boxes for babies who are stillborn, and the power of that for parents to have something. And the crux of the idea is that grief can be diminished if you try to forget, or if you literally bury it. You know, that's not actually the case.
It's not true.
Yeah.
So the bereavement midwife that I interviewed, who she's a midwife. She was used to be a normal midwife, but now in her middle age, she specializes in babies who aren't going to live very long outside of the womb, so minutes or hours, or who are going to be born stillborn. And she makes these memory boxes that you can take home. So if it was all too much for you to think about at the time, there is always going to be something for you to come to, you know, handprints or photographs of the baby. But she was telling me that it came from a place of wanting to do good. Mm. Fathers and other family members would, while the mother was kind of out of it and still recovering from the birth, would have the baby cremated without speaking to her and without her getting a chance to hold the baby, to be with the body, because they felt that her seeing this baby again would just hurt her and she wouldn't be able to handle it. And it was, you know, they thought burying it, pretending it didn't happen would help, but she would come out of this and relationships would not survive it. Mothers would be distraught. And part of these memory boxes was there was one mother in particular whose husband didn't want her to have a memory box made because he wanted the baby gone. He wanted all memory of the baby gone. And the mother had said in a kind of quiet word to the nurses, "I actually do want one. Could you make me one?" And they made her a secret one and they kind of shoved it in her suitcase as she was leaving. And a couple of months later, this mother phoned the bereavement ward and said, "My husband found it and he's destroyed it. Do you have any copies that I can have?" And because of this new law in the UK where you can't, the data protection law, they hadn't been able to retain any of the pictures, so everything she had was gone. And I thought about that man for so long. Mm. I would kill him. I just could not believe it. But again, that's like an extreme version of somebody telling you how to grieve and how you should feel and when is the correct time to stop grieving somebody. And it is so personal and no two people are going to be the same. And babies especially are a tricky place. And you need to go with what you believe is right.
So let's talk about the emotional toll. Firstly, on those you interviewed and how they managed to do their work, and then maybe we could segue into the experience you had meeting them. And I mean, I think there was that quite a lot of, you know, there are some gruesome things that you describe. And how do those who work in that field manage?
I went into this kind of thinking that people would be detached, because you kind of hear that in TV shows and movies, other people are detached. And I found that to be not true. They're not detached at all. They are more aware and more connected to what they're doing than we have any idea of. But what they've managed to do is compartmentalize it so that they can continue to do their job without falling apart. And they do it in various ways. There are, I found that each person who did their job only looked at their one patch of death. So they were all like kind of workers on a, you know, what's that thing called?
Conveyor belt.
Yeah. So they were just looking at their one bit and then the body moved on to the next person. And so it was all very much blinkered. And the emotional toll on me, I think, came from the fact that I was trying to see all of it. Mm-hmm. And apparently that was unusual. I didn't think it was going to be unusual. I thought if I went and spoke to somebody who did autopsies for a living, there would be no part of death that creeped them out or made them uncomfortable. And I found that was untrue. The person who did the autopsies didn't want to speak to the grieving families because that was too much. The man in the crematorium who had been burning bodies in a basement for 30 years could not believe I had dressed a dead man. He thought that was gross. He's like, "Oh, I don't want to touch him." But I tried to see all of it, and so it kind of it knocked me on my ass for a long time. And that is one of the reasons why my book was so, so late, because I was trying to figure it all out, and rather than just let horrific things that could be horrific float around my head for ages, I was trying to put them in an order and give them meaning. And a really good conversation I had was with a homicide detective in Wales who said that you'll never get rid of the pictures. You just have to find a way to give them meaning. And I think writing the book was really helpful in... Otherwise it was just a dead baby I saw, or a severed head or something. But yeah, it took.
So was it? Do you think it was cumulative, or were there just one or two standout moments? I think I know the answer to this question, but I'd like you to tell the audience.
I was completely fine with everything. I was quite cocky, thinking I'd be fine with everything. But there was one thing that I wasn't, and that was when I went to see the autopsy, and it was just for an adult human. I had gone, and I had been warned before I went in there that this pathology department was also a pediatric pathology department, and they said you may see babies or children when you go there. And I was like, oh, it's fine. It's probably no different. And so I was watching the adult autopsy, and in the corner of the room was a baby. And he was being taken apart because they suspected the mother had killed him. And so there were two police watching, and they were taking the body apart, and they were looking at every tiny rib, checking it for fractures. And he was comprehensively taken apart. But when he was like that, he was science and biology, and I wasn't emotionally affected by him because I was trying to do this thing where I just observed everything and had my feelings about it later. That's how I get my job done. But it was when he was all sewn up, and the person who was, they're called anatomical pathology technologists, and they basically do the practical work of taking a body apart for the pathologist, and they put the body back together. And it was when one of these girls was, he was all sewn up, and she was giving him a little bath just in a tub. And it was like my mum used to bathe my baby sister in the kitchen sink. And he was slipping below the waterline. And I was trying not to be in the way, because one of the things that is, if you get in the way as a journalist, you are not invited back to places. So I was trying to keep out of the way. But standing beside this baby, watching him slip under and not doing anything, was so beyond anything that was inbuilt in me that I had some kind of mind flip. But when he was apart, you know, it was just, you know, I saw his heart, I saw his ribs, his lungs. That was different. When he was in the tub, it was a domestic scene of a dead baby, and I was doing nothing, and it ruined me. So part of dealing with that was talking to the bereavement midwife, who was telling me about why she had done her job, and her job was, she didn't want to be near dead bodies, dead babies. She didn't want to be sent to the side of a woman who was about to lose her baby because she didn't know how to make it better. It was like watching babies die. So I found talking with her was really therapeutic, because she ran towards the thing that horrified her, and she found a way to make it, she couldn't make the situation better, but she could make it less bad for the family. And she felt like she was doing something. And I think what upset me about the baby in the tub was I didn't feel like I was doing anything, watching.
And you also write about how it was just that, where there's that clash of, you know, there's things that you expect in a particular environment, and then when something's outside of that, that's when it has the most emotional impact.
Surreal.
There was another wonderful point I wanted to make that was related to that, and I can't find it right now, but I'll come back to that. So with the, circling back a little bit to embalmers, I was astonished to hear that they can work in some places from 4 a.m. in the morning to 10 p.m. at night. And I also found a recent article published here in Australia that showed that one of the, someone speculated that one of the reasons that embalming was less common here was because there's a massive shortage of embalmers. And with working hours like that, there's no wonder. And most of the people that you've interviewed in the book are men, but there is an increase. There's a growing number of women working in the death industry. Can you talk about how it's been traditionally very male-dominated and why that, and your thoughts about why that's changing?
Originally, centuries ago, birth and death were women's work. Mm. And then in the 20th century, it was kind of taken off them and it was turned into a commercial enterprise. And like with most workforces, women were not part of it. Now women, like with everything, there are more women involved. But the funeral industry in particular, I looked at the statistics for a mortician school in America, and it was 80% women. And when you ask people about it, you'll get some pretty silly answers about, women are more caring, they're more compassionate. And I've met some pretty horrible women, so I'm not sure that I'm not sure that I buy that completely. But it is true that there are more women involved. And what my personal theory is that women are more connected to the blood and gore of being alive. And time passes for women in a way it doesn't pass for men. And I wonder if just that, daily closeness to time and gore, I wonder if that has something to do with women being closer. Well, they just keep coming and working in the funeral industry. It's getting bigger and bigger and bigger, combined with the stuff about compassion and all of that. So that's my theory. And I also wonder if people are more comfortable talking to women as funeral directors, instead of a stiff man in the suit, if you're more comfortable saying what you want in a funeral. I don't know. But to me, I think it's a more visceral thing.
And even Kevin noted that with training embalmers that there was, something like 80% of his students were women. So yeah. It's not just at that front line of the interpersonal relationships.
Yeah. Something I found when I was trying to sell this book is it's mostly women who work in publishing in the UK, and a lot of them are called Hannah for some reason. but I found that when my agent at the time was a man, and if I ever went into a meeting where there was a man as well as women, it was the women who would ask the grossest questions about death, the most brutal stuff. And the men would get really uncomfortable. My agent was like, he started to not want to come with me into my meetings because he's like, it gets really brutal, emotionally brutal, but also women want to talk about the gore and the bodies. And I don't know what's up with that. I mean, I fit in that same category, so how can I explain myself?
The other thing that is, an industry thing, a global thing, is looking at the impact on the environment of how we bury or cremate. And you've been writing more recently about some of the innovation and technology that is changing that. So there are all sorts of changes happening. What do you see them? What do you think is the most hopeful changes as far as the environment goes that are on the horizon?
Well, one of the reasons I don't like embalming, apart from the fact that I think it is kind of a white lie, because if you're going to see a freshly dead body, there's nothing frightening about it. It looks like a dead body, but it's not. There's nothing frightening about that. Another reason I don't like it is if you're burying it or burning it, all the chemicals that you've put into that body are then going to go into the environment, whether it's into the ground or into the sky. The mercury in your teeth will go into the sky if you cremate a body. Something I've been really interested in the last few years is something called alkaline hydrolysis, or water cremation. And I've been to see these machines, which are legal in some states in America, where a body goes into this tank with superheated water and essentially lye. and it takes a couple of hours, and everything biological breaks down, turns into this sterile liquid that looks like tea, which can then go into the water system, go to the water treatment plant, and that's done away with. And at the end, you're left with a perfectly white skeleton. And cremains that you collect from the crematorium is a skeleton that has been pulverized in a kind of blender. And not many people actually think about the fact that you are collecting pulverized bones, but you are. So in alkaline hydrolysis, it's the same thing, but at the end you get, it looks like a huge bag of cocaine because it's white. Whereas cremains kind of look like cat litter. So it feels cleaner, it feels more gentle. I've seen cremation by fire and water, and I would personally prefer water because it seems more gentle. But it's also much better for the environment because chemicals and everything are sterilized. And also, any implants you have, whether it's a breast implant or a knee or a hip or the stents that are propping open the chambers of your heart, they all wash up on the tray at the end with the skeleton, and that can be recycled, which I think is amazing, rather than just put in the ground with all the other knees and hips.
Yeah. Actually, when I read your book, it hadn't even occurred to me because there's natural burial grounds here in the Northern Rivers, and there are several in New Zealand, and in the UK there's a big growth of them. But I hadn't thought about, you know, you could do everything, you know, put somebody in a friendly coffin or in a shroud, but I hadn't thought about the internal bits going into the ground.
It's even, you know, chemotherapeutic drugs as well. Everything we take in goes into the ground. And there have been cases in Ireland where flooding meant that embalming fluid was leaching out of the coffins and into the drinking water, which is something that could have... You know, we don't have to live like this. There are better ways. In the UK, it was announced a couple of months ago that one of the main funeral chains was going to start offering water cremation. And there were all these horrible opinion articles about, oh, there's going to be like mince bodies in the drains. And it was all, they were taking an article I had written for Wired magazine 6 years ago, twisting it and putting a horrible opinion on it. And I'm like, well, you people haven't even gone to see the machine. You have no idea what you're talking about, and you're just going, ugh. But I think if you look at any part of what we do with dead bodies, burying them, burning them, dissolving them, you could go, ugh, at all of them. The only reason we're not doing that is because it's normal. We don't think about it. So much of death is just... We don't think about it because it's always been that way. And so water cremation is getting a lot of scrutiny and a lot of horrible opinion articles written by idiots. When I think it's something good. And also because crematoriums tend to be, they're not nice places to be around. They're really hot. And as family members, you can go down and be there within, like near the oven, but not many people do. And I can see why. But there are places in America where this has been legal for long enough that they've managed to build little buildings to incorporate this in. And they've got like water features, and you can have your whole ceremony there, and you can be there for the lot. You can put your people in the tank.
There's some R&D into composting human bodies too, isn't
there's also composting, composting.
And have you heard of the mushroom suit?
I have.
That's my favourite.
I think mushrooms are gross.
I don't mind mushrooms. So let's talk about the people who are trying to cheat death, which is your final chapter, The Hopeful Dead, which is a great title.
Well, I thought it would be like an interesting end to a book about people who they spend their lives believing death to be this practical, unavoidable thing and dealing with that. And I thought I want to go and talk to the people who think it's not and who think that they can cheat it by freezing themselves. And also, everything I know about cryonics is something I've learned from Futurama or from that Woody Allen movie, Sleeper. And I wanted to see what it was really like. And I thought I was just going to go and see crazy people. It was one of those interviews where I had the opinion formed already. And when I got there, I found just these really sweet nerds who didn't even believe it would happen. They were like science fiction convention people. They were like, well, we know what happens when you put a body in the ground, and we know what happens if you burn them. So we see ourselves as kind of the experiment, and that is the control. And they've got this warehouse. It was just outside Detroit, where they have these, they're kind of like massive thermos bottles, and they put the body through a process of embalming, but they're injecting them with a kind of antifreeze, and then they hang them upside down in sleeping bags like bats, like the ones over there that were screaming. And then they fill the tank with liquid nitrogen, and they hang them upside down because they figure that if there's ever a leak, they want your head to be the last thing to thaw, because they can build you a body in the future, but they can't build a whole person from a toe. What I loved was they have these whole things figured out. They've even thought about what's going to happen if you had like five wives. Do you defrost and fix all of them, or do you just go with the first one? Crazy.
All sorts of moral dilemmas. It was amazing. But you discovered that, to your surprise, they didn't fear death.
No. They didn't do it because they were running away from death. They just saw it as a test. And the main guy who ran the institution was actually Christian. And I thought, isn't it a kind of anti-Christian thing to not believe that, you know, heaven? Because I was brought up Catholic, and death is kind of the thing. You know, you're aiming for death, and then everything will be fine. And this guy, he was like, no, I don't see it as anti-Christian, because I see it as me wanting more of this amazing gift. So that's how he'd made it okay with himself. Mm-hmm. He didn't see it as fearing death. And the woman who did all the embalming was actually an embalmer in a normal funeral home years previously. And she hadn't signed up to be frozen because she just wasn't sure if she wanted more life. She's like, life is hard. So I thought that there was a lot more thought going on than, you know, the fact that they didn't even think it would work. They were just kind of playing around. Mm. Whereas I thought it would be like, you know, they'd be going door to door trying to talk people into it, and they're really not.
Yeah. And Detroit was quite an appropriate environment for all of this to happen, because it feels a bit like a ghost town now.
It does. Detroit is a mad city, and I love it. Most of it, like, it's being fixed now, but most of it is burned down. And so you get, when I went there in January, you get these lone standing houses on these blocks surrounded by ice, and there's nobody there. It's like, sometimes when I left in the aeroplane, you can see these outlines of the houses that used to be there. So this frozen house is there among these ghosts of other houses. And it made me think that even if cryonics does work, is that desirable? To be reanimated hundreds of years from now, when everyone you love is dead, and you are alone in this new place. It just seems, I wouldn't want that.
Yeah, very clear on that. You write, death shows us what is buried in the living. By shielding ourselves from what happens past the moment of death, we deny ourselves a deeper understanding of who we truly are. How did this book change you?
I have become far less patient with stuff that doesn't matter. And I found this, again, like, it wasn't just me. It was one of the detectives I spoke to, the one who worked at the disaster recovery company. He said he lost his job, or sort of gave it up, as a policeman because he could not be asked to fill out any more forms. He's like, I have seen the worst thing that can happen, and I have seen death and death and death, and I cannot be bothered with forms, so I can't be a policeman anymore because it's mostly paperwork. So it's changed me in that I have more patience with people, but less patience for stuff that doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. I can't be bothered holding grudges anymore. Like, I finished this book and, you know how you have your little nemeses that you Google, see how they're doing? Don't care.
Yeah.
I wish them well.
Yeah. And you, I think you also say that you find yourself mourning people while they're still here.
Yeah.
Is just appreciating
Just appreciating people.
Forever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've got these serious... For some reason, I find the back of people's heads heartbreaking, whether it's people or cats or whatever. And I've got this series of pictures of my dad when he comes to stay in my flat in London, and he'll be sitting at the table. And from the kitchen, it's just the back of his head. And I'll take a picture, but the back of his head was always, and my mum will agree with me, the back of his head was the thing we saw the most of him, because he was always at his drawing board. Mm. And he says that's why he went grey first from the back of his head. It was everybody staring at him going... What are you doing? But yeah, just little things. I don't think it's a sentimentality. I think it's just an acknowledgement of things being fleeting.
And being grateful for them. So please join me in showing your appreciation for the wonderful Hayley Campbell.
We hope you've enjoyed this podcast. You can find more of our festival conversations online at byronwritersfestival.com/digital.